Today's episode is brought to you by the new podcast from Chapo Trap House's Matt Chrisman and Chris Wade, Hell of Presidents. From Washington to Biden, Hell of Presidents is telling the history of the United States through the office of the presidency, all in the irreverent Chapo Trap House style. Who were all these men and why should you even really care? Listen to Hell of Presidents to find out. Hell of Presidents is available exclusively on Stitcher Premium. To sign up and get a free month of listening, go to stitcherpremium.com/hell on your mobile or desktop browser. Click Start Free Trial, select a monthly plan, and enter the code HELL at stitcherpremium.com/hell, promo code HELL. And now for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, August 16th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, Associate Professor of History at Loyola Chicago University and author of Indentured Students, How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in College Debt. Also on the program today, Kabul falls to the Taliban as our 20-year delusion exposed. Meanwhile, thousands flee as Taliban declares that the Afghanistan war is over. So begins the national amnesia over George Bush's disastrous decisions, Obama's weakness, and Trump's cravenness. And, for that matter, the Afghan papers. Meanwhile, a massive earthquake strikes Haiti, killing hundreds. CDC panel backs up the FDA on third shots for immunocompromised as the vaccination rate across all people jumps. In this country, anyways. Also jumping, COVID deaths rise by 74% in Florida as Oregon deploys the National Guard to help in hospitals. New report, nearly half of U.S. workers don't earn enough to afford a one-bedroom rental in this country. Biden administration approves new nutrition standards, which will create the largest permanent food stamp benefit increase in the program's history. A 25% bump in benefits for the 42 some odd million people receiving food stamps. Trump appointed judge orders the Biden administration to reinstate the remain in Mexico policy. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Joining me as always and desperately trying to get her
keyboard to work,
Emma Vigeland. Hello.
Hi.
Emma, did you manage?
We'll see. Gotta connect it.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thanks.
Folks, I don't know if you've seen the horrible images coming out of the Kabul airport as the Taliban have basically all but taken over all of Afghanistan, and maybe not even all but. President of Afghanistan in exile now. Taliban has declared that the Afghanistan war is over. And months ago, when Joe Biden announced this, I think I made a point at that time to say that this is going to be incredibly ugly. And I don't know that people anticipated, or even that I anticipated, that it would be this ugly on day one. But it's going to get uglier, too. And this was an inevitability. And if anything, it shows the folly of our presence there. It's a house of cards. And we got word of this a couple of years ago during the Trump administration. And that was in the release, of the Afghanistan papers, which made it quite clear that the military, that our politicians have been lying about any successes in that country for well over a decade. Close to two decades of just lying to the American public. And no one wanted to be the guy. I mean, it's all been men who wanted to have these images on the day that the American military left. And that's why it didn't happen before now. Now, that said, Donald Trump, and we will play this later in the show, made it quite clear that he wanted credit for ending this. Months ago, maybe close to a year ago now, the Trump administration made a deal with the Taliban to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners so that there would be less conflict there as a way of protecting Donald Trump's bid to be reelected. Many of those prisoners are now in the leadership of the Taliban. I don't know that that made a material difference for what we've seen in the pace of the fall. I think there was some notion that the Taliban would take over the entire country and not Kabul. But again, this was all just sort of, built on a foundation of sand. It was all a house of cards, however you want to express it. It's been a delusion. And it's a delusion that is being propagated by a delusion that's being propagated not only by the military, not only by some of our politicians, but also our media. Check out this clip of Jake Tapper. Just completely, and we're seeing this across the board, right? This massive failure for Joe Biden. The failure already existed. It was
a failure of United States imperialism.
Yes, the failure has been there for decades. The war on terror. I mean, there's multiple different ways you could slice this, right? You could have said that. You could say that it was a failure to invade Afghanistan from the beginning.
Instead of maybe Saudi Arabia.
Anywhere.
Not invading anywhere, but for Saudi Arabia's involvement in 9/11,
invaded
Afghanistan.
But bin Laden was in Afghanistan.
And then within the weeks, Taliban, we were able to get a surrender option from the Taliban.
Taliban said that they would be willing to hand over bin Laden. Failure point number one. Failure point number two was to accept the surrender of the Taliban once you've invaded. Failure point number three was to leave all of your forces, to leave all of your resources, to pull them out of Afghanistan. Instead of building institutions, instead of building a some type of form, and I don't know if we could have done it, but certainly we weren't going to do it once the decision was made, which may have been made even before we went into Afghanistan, that we were going to pull all those resources from Iraq. And then the failure was by the Obama administration to come in and realize, like, this is a disaster. And are we going to put good money after bad, as it were? And it turned out we're going to put good money after bad.
It's on cost fallacy.
Well, at that point, Obama said that was the good war, right?
That was the good war. But when he got into office, he could have said, you know what? It turns out the good war is not working. But instead, That good money is just a euphemism for killing more civilians, losing more U.S. lives, and kicking the can down the road. Trump did the same exact thing. God knows what would have happened in May if he had been reelected, if he would have held, actually followed through on that. Nevertheless, here we are, and the U.S. media is making it as if this problem was a problem that developed in the past 2 months. Here is Jake Tapper interviewing Tony Blinken.
Scott, Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Secretary Blinken, thanks so much for joining us. Take a listen to what President Biden was saying less than 6 weeks ago.
Your own intelligence community has assessed that the Afghan government will likely collapse.
That is not true. They did not reach that conclusion. There's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of a embassy. The likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely.
Secretary Blinken, as you know, the Taliban has closed in on Kabul. We're evacuating the embassy, burning documents. Biden increased troops, deploying to the country twice in 3 days just to rescue those there. This is not just about the overall idea of leaving Afghanistan. This is about leaving hastily and ineptly. Secretary Blinken, how did President Biden get this so wrong?
Jake, first, let's put this in context. And as we've discussed before, we were in Afghanistan for one overriding purpose, to deal with the folks who attacked us on 9/11. That's why we went there 20 years ago. And over those 20 years, we brought bin Laden to justice. We vastly diminished the threat posed by al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to the United States, to the point where it's not capable of conducting such an attack again from Afghanistan. We're going to keep in place in the region the capacity to see if any reemergence of a terrorist threat and to be able to deal with it. And on the terms that we went into Afghanistan in the first place, we've succeeded in achieving our objectives. When the president came to office, he had a decision to make. The previous administration negotiated an agreement with the Taliban that said that our forces, our remaining forces, only about 2,500, would be out of the country on May 1st. And the idea that the status quo could have been maintained by keeping our forces there, I think is simply wrong. The fact of the matter is, had the president decided to keep forces in Afghanistan beyond May 1st, attacks would have resumed on our forces. The Taliban had not been attacking our forces or NATO during the period from which the agreement was reached to May 1st. The offensive you're seeing across the country now to take these provincial capitals would have commenced.
In other words, there was no, I mean, did Joe Biden get along or get it wrong, or was he lying? I mean, could he have possibly said, no, it's going to collapse within moments as the planes take off. And yeah, we're probably going to have to fight our way out. If he had said that a month or two ago, would there be the will, or would, you know, everyone on CNN or wherever it is, MSNBC, I'm sure there are same people who are complaining about the same thing on every single news network. We can't leave. We can't leave and have that happen. It was inevitable. There is no time that we could stay. We could stay there for another 20 years and it would be exactly the same.
We could have gone back in time and say we were going to occupy a country for 2 decades, actually use the over $1 trillion that we spent on the war, specifically in Afghanistan, to set up infrastructure, to set up institutions that would have created a government that would not have been so susceptible to kleptocracy and to the Taliban taking over so swiftly. It's an indictment of the premise that the United States' imperialist wars do anything except destroy, that we saw this fold so immediately. If the United States wanted to occupy a nation for 20 years, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly, they could have spent that money on creating a government and structures and investments that wouldn't have led to this. But we didn't do that. We used that money to enrich defense contractors. It was a very profitable war. Afghanistan was just collateral damage for the looting of U.S. taxpayer dollars to go directly to Lockheed Martin and other defense contractors, Boeing, etc. So that's what this was. And it was a war of lashing out after 9/11. Bin Laden was located there. So Afghanistan, which already had faced the brunt of U.S. imperialism decades before, of course, just collateral damage. And then now the media, which supported those efforts decade after decade, turns around and say, well, what about the women and children of Afghanistan? What about people there? Yes, that's what we've been saying the whole time.
Okay, I just want to bring up, if we have time, how much, you know, we're talking about if we're going to learn any lessons. This is the concept of the decent interval from Vietnam. Decent interval is a theory regarding the end of the Vietnam War, which argues that from 1971 or 1972, the Nixon administration abandoned the goal of preserving South Vietnam and instead aimed to save face by preserving a decent interval between withdrawal and South Vietnamese collapse. Therefore, Nixon could avoid becoming the first United States president to lose a war. Like, this seems to be, like, the main thing we're preoccupied in
absolutely.
Wars, how do we save face when we retreat?
Absolutely. This is why Obama should have done this 10 years ago. And this is why it's happening now. Let's watch Jake Tapper go on and make this point about, like, I love this concept of a Saigon moment. It's not a Saigon moment. I mean, it's not like the definition of this is not a function of us flying out of there and people hanging on to the planes or the helicopters, as it were, at Saigon. The definition of this is the real lesson is that we can't do what we think we can do. And we need to stop pretending
to think that to do what we think we can do is my point, too. Like, we can't do what we think we can do, which is, you know, set up infrastructure by not. And we didn't even put the effort to do it. Do the effort, you know?
Here's clip number two.
This troop surge to airlift Americans out of Afghanistan, aren't we already in the midst of a Saigon moment?
No, we're not. Remember, this is not Saigon. We went to Afghanistan 20 years ago with one mission, and that mission was to deal with the folks who attacked us on 9/11. And we have succeeded in that mission. The objective that we set, bringing those who attacked us to justice, making sure that they couldn't attack us again from Afghanistan, we've succeeded in that mission. And in fact, we succeeded a while ago. And at the same time, remaining in Afghanistan for another 1, 5, 10 years is not in the national interest. You know, the British were there for a long time in the 19th century. The Russians were there for a long time in the 20th century. We've now been there twice as long as the Russians. And how that's in our national interest, I don't see. And as I mentioned a moment ago, I think most of our strategic competitors around the world would like nothing better than for us to remain in Afghanistan for another year, 5 years, 10 years, and have those resources dedicated to being in the midst of a civil war. It's simply not in our interest.
I mean, he's right there. He's right there. I mean, I don't I don't like the use of justice to include just assassination in terms of bin Laden. Nevertheless, this is defined by the disaster that existed. I mean, you could argue on some level that it's a Saigon moment, but it's not really a Saigon moment. You could argue it's a Vietnam moment, if you will. And that moment is, you know, years in the making.
And right. What's the through line? And what's the through line?
It's been a Vietnam, like, couple of decades or four decades, depending on how you look at it.
Right. Isn't this just another situation of we had a moment that allowed us to sort of reflect on the fact that, like, this was, wait, what? Wait, we just did what? For how long and how many people died and for what reason? That's what this moment is. This is not a moment of helicopters taking off or planes taking off and some bad images on video. This is another moment of us realizing, like, hey, we just wasted tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives and money and for absolutely, really not much, if anything.
For what? Like, and that's the question.
We were able to assassinate bin Laden.
Well, we could have had him right away.
Well, we also got to feed the war dogs for decades.
Right. Well, although not even really, because they were still hungry enough to launch a second war that killed even more people.
Right. Well, we got to operate a U.S. police state very lazily for 20 years and then burn a bunch of money and result in the deaths of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, which interestingly is not at the forefront of that conversation between Jake Tapper and Blinken there, by the way.
It's probably longer than they spent on the Afghanistan papers. And, you know, it really, like I say, you can find one clip from those. We got the Afghan forces we deserved. Douglas Lute, an Army lieutenant general, served in the White House's Afghan war czar under Presidents George W. Bush and Obama, told government interviewers, if the U.S. government had ramped up training between 2002 and 2006, when the Taliban was weak and disorganized, things may have been different, Lute added. Instead, we went to Iraq. If we committed money deliberately and sooner, we could have had a different outcome. And maybe that is the case. And that's the one that, I mean, that's the failure on the terms of the most hawkish. Never mind those that say that we shouldn't have gone in when we had the opportunity to just get bin Laden served up to us. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking student debt with Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, Associate Professor of History at Loyola Chicago University, author of Indentured Students, How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in College Debt. We'll be right back. Got a sponsor for today's show. Well, we've talked about this outfit quite a bit. In fact, Bradley sitting over there is via ZipRecruiter once removed. As you know, some things in life we like to pick ourselves, so we know we got the one that's best for us. Maybe it's like a mattress. Maybe it's your clothes. Whatever it is. If you do the same for hiring, but what if you could do the same for hiring? What if you could choose your ideal candidate before they even apply? That's where ZipRecruiter's invite to apply comes in. It gives you, the hiring manager, the power to pick your favorites from top candidates. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send you the most qualified people for your job. Then you can easily review the candidates. You invite your top choices to apply for your job. Lauren Webb, SVP of Talent Acquisition for Mindula Health, raves about the invite to apply. She said, quote, I love that feature because we have a much higher follow-through rate if I invite candidates. According to ZipRecruiter internal data, jobs where employers use ZipRecruiter's invite to apply get on average 2.5 times more candidates. This, of course, helps for making a faster hiring process. We've had a lot of success here with ZipRecruiter. Like I say, found Bradley through Brendan, who we found through ZipRecruiter. See for yourself. Just go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, I want to welcome to the program Elizabeth Tandy Shermer. She's an associate professor of history at Loyola Chicago University, author of Indentured Students, How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in College Debt. Elizabeth, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, it's nice. Thank you for inviting me on. I'm really excited to be able to talk about the book and to be on your program, for sure.
Oh, well, thank you. All right, let's. And so you basically do a history of the development of student loans in this country, and sort of the I don't know, the quicksand, I guess, it's sort of created, or I don't know how better to describe.
No, I think it's also a story, I think, of like the absolute worst of intentions, you know, if you really think about it. But yeah, you can absolutely just sort of see it sinking. It's funny, because what I always think of, like, when you look at the projections of the debt that's increased, it's always going upward. But yeah, we're just sort of sinking into this morass, which is why, you know, just continuing to extend the moratorium or even just forgiving the debt is not enough to stop this.
All right. Well, let's I want to circle back around to that. But first, give us some statistics on just sort of like the steepest part of that trajectory or the steepest part of the decline, depending on how you want to assess it.
Well, and that's actually one of the challenges. So it looks like the steepest part of the trajectory has really been in the Great Recession era and on forward, right? Absolutely. In terms of looking at just actually the jump in college costs and the amount borrowed. However, real data on this was not collected until 2008. And that starts to change everything because that's actually more than 50 years after the first federal loan program. And when you actually go back to it, because I think that that's what's challenging for folks is that they look back at the past and they see just a couple of thousand dollars in terms of how much it costs to go to college. So in the early 60s, it's about I can't remember the exact, but it's a couple thousand dollars to go to college, like the entire expense of it in the early 60s. But JFK points out to a reluctant Congress, that's more than the median household income. We cannot expect people to borrow this much. But of course, now it has become just this expectation that that is what you do. That was what you do.
So, all right. Well, I mean, I think if I remember correctly, it was something like $4,500 for college, and maybe the median income was a little bit less. But so, what did people do at that time? I mean, I remember my step grandfather kept telling me over and over again how he paid himself, paid his way through Harvard. You know, I guess this must have been. Maybe in the early 1930s, maybe, or something like that.
Well, he might have actually been a part of the work study program, the federal work study program, which was an early experiment. And that's a great example, actually, about how we get into this quicksand, because instead of actually sort of recognizing initially the New Dealers did not, the Roosevelt administration did not, how important it was to have an educated country, to actually how important colleges and universities were actually to the fabric of it, that they actually had this work study program. And it's something that colleges and universities would tolerate, that basically what the federal government was doing was paying students to work. And the colleges and universities got to assign what the jobs that they were doing. And so that's exactly what it was. And even that work study program, which was beloved at the time, and like so many things in this country, was a political casualty of partisanship. It actually made it possible for millions, or excuse me, 600,000 young people to actually go to college. And it also was a way of wedging open that door of college and universities like Harvard that had no interest in admitting Catholics, Jews, people of color. It was a way of incentivizing them as opposed to forcing them. But a lot of it was working, or just dropping out and not going at all.
Right. Okay. Since 2007, you say this, into the student debt has tripled, is my understanding. Tuition since 1980 has gone up 800%. That's extraordinary. Like, I just don't even understand, like, how the numbers prior to that could like, there's not enough room, it seems to me, when you're talking about, you know, for that kind of money, for that type of growth. And that, I mean, that, you know, I, a lot of our audience, a younger audience, 1980, that seems like forever ago. But, you know, I went to college in the mid 1980s. And so I'm old, but I'm not that old. And I mean, this seems to me to like the velocity of the rate of the problem seems to have like really picked up. So tell us, like, what was, once that the decision was made during the New Deal that there was value in education, to have a citizenry that was educated with higher education, where does it go from there?
The big fight is over direct spending. Are we going to directly spend on college and universities to free them of their historic reliance on tuition? Is that what we're going to do? And it always, always sort of founders on the questions of, that means that schools, if you're going to get federal money, you have got to be desegregated. And it is a massive fight. It also is a huge fight about, can you give federal money to support college universities that have a religious affiliation? It's huge. And is it continually what derails everything is an unwillingness to really tackle the larger questions of white supremacy in the country, period. That is what happens. And tuition assistance is an easy way to get around that. You're assisting the students so that they can spend the money where they will, what schools will admit them. And you're not challenging schools on who they admit. That's the Civil Rights Act that actually does not that, not the Higher Education Act. And then in your question about like what happens is sort of in the 80s, that sort of
Elizabeth, hold on. I want to make sure that everybody understands when that's happening and that dynamic. So this is the Higher Education Act of 1965, is the first stab at this. I mean, are we back at 1958 with the National Defense Education Act?
Oh, sure. So the work study program I was talking about is in the 30s. And that's when you get the federal government first dabbling with really getting involved in college and universities in that way. Then you have the very famous GI Bill, right? The GI Bill of the mid 40s, and that carries on into early 50s, the very first one. And that again is paying the colleges and universities directly for the tuition for soldiers and giving them what they called a subsistence check, which was designed not to be enough for them to actually really make to have the spending money to go to the movies or anything like that. And it actually, unfortunately, the sad part about the GI Bill, we think about it as this huge success, but you had GIs having to borrow, desperately trying to find work to be able to live and actually study, often having to drop out if they could find them, because they're rare at the time, they could actually take out student loans. But what keeps derailing all this idea about having direct funding for college and universities is throughout the 40s and the 50s over this question of segregation and about supporting the separation between church and state. And the breakthrough is actually, it's true that the Sputnik legislation, that satellite, and I love that story, especially when everyone wants to tell me that the partisan divides are sort of new in this country. The story is usually told that there's this small satellite and automatically there's all this investment in college universities. Actually, it was a year of fighting in Congress and the White House. And what you got was a limited temporary bill. The most important part of it, the last minute, was shoving in a loan program. It would be followed in 65 by a loan program. But the key thing that made the Higher Education Act of 1965 possible was the passage of the Civil Rights Act, because it ended that discussion about what we were going to do about all these segregated colleges and universities.
All right. So let me just ask you one question about going back to the GI Bill. Why did they specifically frame it in such a way that they would just have just a subsistence that ended up being less than needed? Like what was the theory behind that?
That was the theory about it that's the thing that's so hard, is that we have this entire narrative of celebrating the greatest generation. But at the time, that took a while to take hold, right? And actually, it's something, within my lifetime as a millennial, that's really sort of come out, that idea of the greatest generation. But at the time, you had colleges, there was this real fear that they were giving away too much in the GI Bill. And again, it's another piece of legislation that we love that barely passed and had a lot of really hard compromises behind it. And it had some really sort of, the politics of it were really kind of crazy, because you had the very conservative American Legion fighting for more benefits, trying to get it through a conservative controlled Congress, conservative Democrats from the South, conservative Republicans from across the country, trying to limit the benefits the federal government is going to go. And one of the ways to do that is like, okay, fine, you want to send these soldiers to college, you're just going to make sure that they're not going to be living high off the hog, that they're not going to get this un-American free ride to school, that they're actually going to study, get out there, not live high on the hog, which is a completely different way than how we think of the greatest generation. For me, and I should say that academics were guilty in this, Robert Hutchins, the head of the University of Chicago, usually celebrated as this great civil libertarian, he flat out said that the GI Bill was going to turn colleges and universities into hobo jungles. That's what he thought of the greatest generation coming back.
So it was strictly an ideological issue. I mean, there was no money that was invested, behind this ideology. It was just strictly an ideological perspective on
Yeah, they're having a huge fight. It's one of the biggest fights. Is like, you know, FDR, you know, very famously says, he has this great press conference where he says, Dr. Win the war, this is late in the war, is doing a great job, but Dr. New Deal is going to come back. And it's a huge fight between conservative and liberals about just what kind of nation we're going to be after this war. Are we going to have much more expansive social welfare protections that was only scratching the surface in the New Deal? And then now we know how much of it really did to support either save the banks through all of those government guarantees that I write about, or also just really help a very small percentage of that white working class, particularly the white men in there. And if that's so much of what our social welfare has been built on for the past 70 years, is it any wonder that this question of the higher education that we're having, as Ayanna Pressley keeps saying, is a racial justice, not just an economic justice issue?
All right, so let's move up to we've got the Higher Education Act in 1965, simultaneous or at least around that time, we have the Civil Rights Act, and that introduces the concept of you cannot discriminate in your institutions of higher learning if you're going to get federal funds, and then in 1972, it is reauthorized and Title IX is added. And that's just basically taking it a little bit further, right?
Well, Title IX for sure, but also added to that. And I think Title IX is, for listeners who don't know, this is really sort of equal opportunities for women to go to college, university. I think one of the, as a historian, it was actually surprising for me, but surprising for a lot of people, is that there wasn't a big discussion about women's ability to go to college in the original discussions of the Civil Rights Act. They're still fighting about making sure that people of color will have access. And they do it in very colorblind ways, connected to the loan program, about incentivizing this ability, and also hiding the money for historically Black college universities under this title for developing institutions, recognizing it's going to take decades to actually desegregate and genuinely integrate. But with the 72,
sorry. The people understand what they within that Higher Education Act, there was money, essentially direct payments for historically Black colleges.
Exactly.
That had to be hidden because you didn't want anybody to politicize it too much. But it was also, like you're saying, a recognition that if we start now, it's going to take still a long time before, and it took longer probably than they anticipated.
What's exciting for me is actually seeing targeted spending openly now, which we haven't seen since the Great Depression, saying this money needs to go to HBCUs or minority serving institutions. It's decades in coming. But to get back to your question about 72 and the Title IX, equal opportunity for women in college. And I think one of the saddest things for me is that we always think of Title IX now as about college sports, but it's about so much more than that. It was at the time about so much more than that. But I think the heartbreaking thing for me is, like, just like with these sort of assumptions that all you need to do is put it in the law, is that it didn't do as much to ensure that women were getting equal opportunities to pay for college. So you still see that women tend to need to borrow more. They're not getting the scholarships. They're not getting the grants, these kinds of things. And it is true that women now are, women are more likely to go to college than men. That's been true since the early 90s. But we tend to have to borrow more and we take longer to pay it off because Title IX does nothing to do to erase the wage gap between either whites and people of color in this country or women and men. It hasn't. And there was this assumption that's all that you would need to do is just get them to go into college, as if that would just erase the historic inequities.
And we should say, there was just a report that came out, I mean, in regards to race anyways, there was just a report that came out, last week, that showed that the wealth gap for Black Americans has gone the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
Because wealth is a function of your assets versus your liabilities. And you can have... First off, the incomes are not growing at the same pace as they are for white people. And the debt load, because there's less intergenerational wealth and these families have less money to lend to their, you know, to give to their kids to go to college or whatnot, this gulf is widened, right?
Absolutely. And I think for me, when I talk about, when I've always talked about the Loan Project, including now, and the book is finally out, is I says that, you know, I focused on the story of the student lending, but it doesn't change the fact that this is a great example about how things that we have assumed were social welfare, it's a lot of financial products. And who gets the guarantee are the bankers. And we have to think about that when we now have this, are thinking about questions of long-term racial wealth gaps, not passing on just generational wealth, but also generational debt. And I think that that's exactly where it gets at to, that if you see that the whole reason, I mean, think about it, Sam, the giving a student loan is a terrible financial product. I'm going to give you a loan for something that I cannot repossess. And if I could repossess it, I can't sell it to anyone else. And if I took it away from you, you wouldn't have the credentials to compete for work to paying me back. But the whole darn thing was modeled off the original New Deal housing program, as if a mortgage is the same as a loan. And the same racial and gender inequities wrapped up in that original federal mortgage program are bound up and have always been in student lending and federal tuition assistance.
And what is the culpability of colleges in this, right? We talk about the increase by 800% in whatever that time period was. I mean, it's a bit symbiotic to have it fall on the student as opposed to kind of having a set payment by the state, for example.
Emma, that's a great question, especially since, you know, the thing about it is that the collateral, your collateral is that you have gotten admission. But colleges and universities, because they don't have the robust direct support that we've always assumed, we all know what happens when you assume, ask me, that they've had. And so it has also put this incredible burden. And also we don't realize that you can't just expand enrollments because it costs a lot of money. You have to invest in the dorms, the cafeterias, the classroom space, the lab space, all of these other kinds of things. But if the historic tradition has been in nonprofit colleges and universities to charge less than the cost of instruction, that's where we get into these questions of how do you compete for students? How do you compete for private donors? How do you compete for state earmarks? And it's really kind of setting these college and universities up for fail when we need them now, when the real wealth is produced in knowledge-driven industries. And also, if we lose a college and university, that's a devastating consequence for the surrounding communities. What about those who are renting to students, who are working on the college and university as staff? What about the businesses? But also, where would we be without the research produced at these college and universities? Why are we expecting students and parents to pay for the research that required the search for the COVID-19 vaccine to figure out the best public health policies to roll them out? All of these things, we're not sort of recognizing that there needs to be a lot more investment in our institutions to better serve the people. Not how just the student parents on there. Sorry.
How much of the increase in tuition? I mean, it seems to me there's two different stories here, or similar stories. One is the story of institutions fighting for students and those tuition dollars by adding to their physical plant and upgrading and getting into some type of like arms race with that regard. But the other is that the cutting off of funding, direct funding, to the extent that there was any for state colleges, let's say, and shifting that burden of paying it onto, you know, making the students more consumers than, you know, recipients of sort of a state-backed institution, a state-backed education, that created upward pressure on tuition rates. I mean, how much?
You can't separate those two stories. And I think the dangerous thing is that, you know, what makes headlines is when some university rolls out a new luxury dorm or something like that. But the other aspect of higher education that folks aren't realizing is that we're a lot like in K-12 schools, that we are expected to deliver more and more social services with less and less support. A great example of this, every single campus in the University of California has a food bank now because of dealing with the question of hunger. And that's not just a question of college students, college students having to borrow so much. That's a question of the quality of the jobs, that you can't just make enough money to pay for college driving for Uber if you can even have a car. We also are providing the housing, that there's a whole way that we're not actually realizing how much these college and universities, just like K through 12 schools, are providing a lot of vital social services because of a step back in these basic investments. And that's a part of it as well. The other thing I'll say to Devin, and I can certainly come down against colleges and universities for sure, especially on their labor practices in terms of making sure that staff and faculty are paid a living wage, or actually more staff, excuse me, staff are paid a living wage, is that we have to recognize too that you do actually need to upgrade. You do actually need to get rid of the lead pipes in some places of these older college universities. You also have to provide Wi-Fi. That this is just the fundamental things. And that was one of the real shock in the system to a lot of folks when we had academics had everything had to go virtual in March of 2020, is that just a lot of students didn't have their own laptops. We have this mythology about focusing on the most rarefied institutions. And so you have college and universities scrambling to figure out how they're going to enable students to get the connectivity and to get the equipment so that they can still study virtually.
Is that an indictment of the way that the institutions are structured, or the institutions themselves? Because like maybe a more radical approach would be, we got to tear this stuff down and start.
Well, I mean, I think the question is like, I think it is structural. And I think that there are certainly voices in the academy who definitely want to tear it all down and start on, but that still does take money. And that is the question. That's the long and short of it. And that's where something like the College for All Act is a real step in completely re-envisioning how the funding for higher education works, and a recognition that this outdated model never worked all that well to begin with, and that we really need to have something that is genuinely accessible post-secondary education, not just for the good of the individual student, but it benefits all of us. It absolutely does.
Do we need to like start with a fundamentally different perspective on the value of higher education to society, as opposed to it being seen as a value directly to the individual?
Yes, absolutely. Because, and I think it is true, is that, you know, the danger of it because of the cost of tuition is that there's such a focus on the job that the person will get out of college to be able to pay it back. But we've lost in that conversation is that the country actually benefits from a highly educated, highly skilled workforce, that especially in this new global knowledge-driven economy that we have, that is just a fact. But the second part of it is actually recognizing that there's actually community benefits to having these centers of learning. You know, I think about small college towns, and actually even here in Chicago, you know, there's actually providing a lot of community events, you know, to actually add to the arts culture. And how would we have survived the pandemic mentally and emotionally without the arts, whether it is humor, whether it is Twitter poetry, whether it is that is absolutely an aspect of it. But I also think in terms of having a civic engagement and buy-in, one of my favorite parts of the memoirs or writing about the GI Bill is the GIs who actually got their degrees, they don't remember the fact that they actually were barely scraping enough money to pay food for themselves or their family. They don't talk about that. What the memoirs are talking about is this memory of having the chance to do it, and this great civic pride and investment and an idea that I needed to go back and serve my country and to pay back what I have had the opportunity to do, even though they only got the opportunity to to access the GI Bill because they had served in World War II. So it's this extraordinary moment when we're realizing at this moment, we're talking about how divided we are, that actually having these genuine civic spaces where people have the chance to opportunity to feed their minds and really sort of think about themselves as citizens who are supported can actually sort of move us forward as a country, not just for the individual.
All right, so we have just a couple minutes left here. Let's talk about where we're at this point. We've had a moratorium that will last by the time it's over, Well, right now, the Biden administration has pushed it into, I think it's January of 2022. Close to 2 years, a little bit less. Probably a savings in interest of anywhere from like $5,000 to $8,000, right? I mean, per student on average, somewhere around that neighborhood. It's hard to know what's going to happen in January 2022. It's conceivable that they punt the moratorium again, which would save some more money. It's conceivable at one point, you know, once Joe Biden realizes his legislative achievements are over for his term, because it could very well be if they even get this reconciliation done. He says, I'm going to do now another $10,000 of student debt relief. Maybe it'll be 50,000 if, you know, I think it's unlikely at this point, but it's possible. But even if the 50,000 was to go through as pushed by Schumer and Warren and others, that's not enough, is it? Because then we just start essentially the clock starts again, and we still have the same problem that we're just creating this massive debt machine.
Yeah, period. That's exactly what happens. And I think it's also the same thing that we could think about, like when we talk about the eviction question too, is that we're at a moment in time when we actually have to rethink how we got into this mess in the first place and stop keeping with the fundamental way that we did it. One of the reasons that I like the College for All Act, which I do realize that is not which is in the infrastructure bill being the part of the reconciliation bill that is being sort of parsed out now. It's more the limited idea about investment in community colleges, which is important. But the College for All Act, what it's effectively doing is creating a public competitor, sort of like how the federal health insurance program was supposed to be for Obamacare. But back in the New Deal, the Tennessee Valley Act was made just completely lessen the cost of electricity, which fundamentally just turned the lights on in the South and other parts of rural America at the time. But you have a public competitor. That makes a big difference. And it is an actual investment in it. And it's a step towards reimagining what it would mean at the state and federal level to actually invest in the higher education, not just that individuals need, but actually that we as a country as a whole actually need to do. And hopefully maybe even free it from this something that you do between the ages of 18 and 22 or 23, that you can actually, in an era now where Americans are usually sort of changing jobs a lot more often, maybe 6 or 7 years, something like that, that you might need to go back and take the time or have the chance to study something that you're really interested in to see you through whatever dark days come next. That's the sort of the gift and the joy of the humanities. That's what shocked the New Dealers during the Depression. Americans, when they created these programs, they did not want vocational ed. They wanted the chance to go to university to discuss current affairs like you and I are doing now, to read history, to discover the arts. And it's the same thing that the GIs did too when they actually had the chance to go to college. Why are we setting this aside? It's only those wealthy enough and young enough.
To be clear, this act would establish a free public college in each state. And the idea is that it's going to drive down the costs of other colleges or slow the growth of their tuition because people are going to have a free option here, essentially. And this is for not just for community college, but for so how much, let's say the community college thing passes in the reconciliation bill. If you were to get rid of, and you were to get rid of for-profit colleges, which I consider like, you know, arguably a criminal enterprise, broadly speaking, if you were to get rid of those, if you were to take those two off the table, where would we be at in terms of debt?
Where would we be at in terms of debt?
Debt generation. Let's put it that way. Debt generation.
No, because it would basically mean that we would have the first 2 years. It's a way of making the first 2 years of college free. But the College for All Act is also doing something where you have, if you're making less than a family's making less than $125,000, you can also use that at historical Black college universities, MSIs. There's more support for those schools to make sure that low income students have the support that they actually need. So there's actually a lot of really interesting things going in there. But what it does is that it helps with completion questions. What it does, and so that will make sure that you're not having people going to a fifth or sixth year of debt, right? That's also an issue that we have right now. It's taking longer to get to the end of degree. The other thing that it would do is, if you are actually getting the first 2 years of college free through a community college, like those first 2 years, that also is cutting in half the cost over the for the entire 4 years of an undergraduate degree as well.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's a fascinating history, and appreciate your talking to us about it. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, the book is Indentured Students, How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in College Debt. Appreciate your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm.
Thanks. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to wrap up in a moment. All right, just a couple of minutes left here, and we should say that, you know, what there was a piece that Katrina VandenHeuvel wrote 2 years ago now, I guess it was.
I saw that she...
In the Washington Post.
Yeah.
It was an op-ed. She was retweeting it out.
Retweeted it, yeah.
And she made the point that, and we will not see these people. We will not, you know, one of the problems with lionizing someone like George W. Bush... simply because Donald Trump was so horrible, is that it contributes to this notion of, like, you know, we are so far down the road, and our media are just the conventional wisdom is just saying, like, you know, how could we have taken that, driven through that stop sign? As opposed to, like, wait a second, we've been driving for 20 years. Like, how did we get here? If you're looking at anything that happened in the past 2 or 3 months or any decision, and granted, the Biden administration, if we really cared as a country about the Afghani people, we would have 10 to 20,000 refugees in this country already.
Yeah, well, that's
Afghan refugees. And we don't.
And
we were supposedly supposed to bring in 3,500, and only 1,200 have been processed at this point. There's probably thousands, and we saw images of that. But there's thousands who wanted to leave. If we really cared about the Afghani people, left, right, whomever, Jake Tapper would have been talking about, why aren't we getting Afghani civilians out of here 6 months ago? But we didn't, because this country is hostile to refugees. It just is. All right, we've got to say goodbye to the Peacock people. We will see you tomorrow if you're watching us on Peacock. If you're watching us today, we'll continue to rant about this.
Yep.
I mean,
it's more like if you just trash the house and then someone's like, you left the light on in the bedroom.
It's just that there's
that's
just like
waste electricity.
There's no memory. There's no accountability. This accountability should have happened a long time ago. But again, if there was genuine concern about the Afghani people, all the people who are talking about, you know, women will suffer, and the women will suffer in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt. And people who helped us and attempted to build better institutions, they will suffer. If we genuinely cared about them as a country, there would have been enough people who would have said, like, we're going to defend the Biden administration from the attacks that are going to come from the right because they're simply letting in too many refugees from Afghanistan. 100,000 Afghani refugees could come into this country. And we would have no idea. Like, we could absorb them so easily, we would have no idea. The only difference is it would be a couple of, like, cities and towns around the country where you would have, like, you know, Afghani food. And one more, you know, more interesting place to eat. And that's it. We could absorb those people in...
America's as equipped as any place to absorb those people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so,
Do you think they're not talking about the Afghani deaths, Sam? Like, what? We don't have a conversation. I mean, Axios published some scathing piece about the Biden administration's handling of this over the weekend. And the framing was, how disrespectful is this to our American troops? Right. That they died in vain or they suffered in vain. The entire war on terror has been an exercise in suffering in vain. And then you're not going to mention the thousands of people killed in Afghanistan, displaced. It's because that analysis would be used as a framework in the future when there's the next war of American might and imperialism. And then the media would not be able to reckon with that because, like, the entire framework of by which they operate from is about American hegemony and the project of our democracy. It's just ridiculous. They're the children in a fantasy land about what, like, they're supposed to be what the people who are telling the truth about what we do, and they're acting as if they're, you know,
right,
reading Harry Potter, and it's we're Harry versus Voldemort.
All right, we're going to take a break and head into the so-called fun half. May not be as fun as normal today. Disturbing, again, what's happening in Afghanistan. And also, you know, like we say, this is there was a certain inevitability to this, although you didn't need the inevitability. I mean, you could have gotten the Afghani people out quicker, without a doubt. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Check out the AM Quickie as a newsletter. You can sign up for it at majority.fm. Scroll all the way down to the bottom. Put your email in. Promise we will never, ever sell your email address to anybody. Doesn't mean I might not give it all free to Matt for his, like, I invite you to his gaming marathon or wherever it is, but no, we will not give it to anybody, even Matt. Maybe we'll have, like, a special opt-in where Matt Leck will just randomly choose people.
Yeah,
and
honestly,
them.
That should be
like a prize,
right? That's a
actually
bonus.
That's probably a way of
right.
of probably driving membership. One lucky email profferer will get an email from Matt, a personal email.
I don't know. It sounds like a lot of work already.
I don't know if we probably should speak.
Bradley's going to have to draft it. And you're going to sign off on it.
I wish I was the type of person who could take advantage of a bunch of illicitly acquired email addresses. But
but it's just a personal one, like one paragraph where you're just like, hey, what's up? Let me tell you what I did today. Once a week, you just do that.
Oof, that's a lot. Maybe once a month.
No, but Bradley's just going to have to do it. And
Bradley will draft it.
It'll be one of those things where, you know, you get an autograph from some famous person as a kid. It's just RoboSign.
You'll get a text from Bradley on like a Wednesday. What'd you do today? I went to the
thing. No, Bradley's going to make it up.
And then Bradley writes it up, and then you just sign off on it.
No,
Bradley. A little bit of concern.
That's too much work for Matt. It has to be Bradley making up, thinking about what Matt's day would be like.
And maybe we can do like some sort of crypto NFT sort of mix in so I can really make some money somehow in this.
Bradley could also just like describe like what Matt was wearing that day and just
Sweatpants and a t-shirt.
Well, you forgot the hat.
And the hat. And the glasses. Have you debuted your new glasses on Left Reckoning?
New shades.
Yeah, you can check out my new shades on Left Reckoning.
Where'd you get those?
These just at an optical place on Flatbush. But he talked me into like the old 70s style bar up top.
I've been thinking about that.
I love it.
That move.
Yeah.
That's coming back now.
No, I'm ready. I'm a little bit ahead of the wave, as usual.
Yep, there you go. All right. Speaking of the wave, and as usual, what is happening in the Matt Leckin universe of media?
Are going to make us do the wave.
For patrons of Left Reckoning, yesterday we released a talk with Natalie Shore about two of her articles, one on how to use carrots more than sticks in getting people to get vaccinated, and also what Bill Gates and Jeffrey Epstein's relationship says about philanthropy. And about Bill Gates. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that show.
And your show now is financed by the former Mr. Gates, right?
Yeah.
What's her name again?
Melinda.
Melinda Gates. Yeah, that's weird. You don't think that's a conflict at all?
No, I mean, we have the same enemy, so.
Oh, there you go. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Bring back DJ Dennerke.
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.